Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, former Comptroller General of the United States David M. Walker, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and Concord's Policy Director Tori Gorman will join the show to discuss the latest COVID relief package, the idea of a fiscal sustainability commission, and highlights from Walker's latest book, which looks ahead to what America might look like in 2040. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that as soon as they complete work on a pandemic relief package, House Democrats may start drafting an emergency funding bill to beef up capital security. A security review team briefed House members this week on recommendations that include a retractable fencing system around the Capitol, more police, and increased security for lawmakers, among other things. The review came in response to the January 6th insurrection that disrupted the counting of electoral votes for the presidential election. Congressional hearings in the past 2 months have exposed the structure of the Capitol Police Board as inefficient and ripe for overhaul, a sentiment shared by a bipartisan contingent of lawmakers and those who served on the board. House action on the revised $1.9 trillion COVID aid package may slip a day as the chamber waits on the Senate to send over its amended version of the measure. Democrats want to get the bill to President Joe Biden's desk well before unemployment benefits expire March 14th. Biden told reporters that he will sign the measure as soon as he gets it. The pandemic relief package that could become law this week offers a tax sweetener that could cause a hiccup in the filing of tax returns. A Senate tweak to the bill would exempt from federal taxes up to $10,200 in expanded unemployment benefits for the 2020 calendar year. But with tax season already underway, some jobless workers who have already filed their taxes may need to amend their returns to receive the extra tax break. The new complication prompted House Democratic tax writers to renew their request for the IRS to delay its April 15th tax filing deadline. Last year's deadline was extended until July 15th because of the pandemic. As of the end of February, the number of tax returns filed was down by nearly 25% compared to the same time a year ago, lawmakers said. The number of returns processed by the IRS was also down by 31%. Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, Concord's Policy Director Tori Gorman, and former Comptroller General of the United States Dave Walker will join me to discuss the latest COVID relief package, the idea of a fiscal sustainability commission, and highlights from Walker's latest book, which looks ahead to what America might look like in 2040. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby, Tori Gorman, and Dave Walker. Bob is the Concord Coalition's Executive Director. Tori is Concord's Policy Director, both regular contributors and familiar voices on the show. Honorable David M. Walker is a distinguished visiting professor at the U.S. Naval Academy, where he teaches the economics of national security. He served as the Comptroller General of the United States for nearly 10 years and has over 40 years of executive-level experience in the public, private, and nonprofit sectors, including heading three federal agencies and two nonprofits, and receiving appointments by three different presidents, including as Comptroller General, as Assistant Secretary of Labor for the current Employee Benefits Security Administration, and as one of two public trustees for Social Security and Medicare. Dave is also a writer, speaker, media commentator, and has appeared in several major programs and documentaries, including 60 Minutes and the documentary IOUSA. He's authored three books, including one we're going to touch on today, titled America in 2040, Still a Superpower, and a book titled Comeback America, Turning the Country Around and Restoring Fiscal Responsibility, which achieved national bestseller status. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob, Tori, and Dave.
Thank you. to be with you, Chase.
You wrote a piece recently for The Hill that I wanted to sort of kick off this conversation with. There's a lot, obviously, in the news about the latest COVID-19 relief package and reconciliation and sort of what each side is hoping will come out of this and even future legislation. So when I read your op-ed for The Hill, you boiled down all of this COVID relief discussion effectively to how much should we spend for what and based on what criteria. So I wondered if you could just sort of give the lay of the land from your perspective on, you know, what should be coming down the pike relative to what is.
Well, first, I think we have to recognize that COVID-19 truly is a national emergency from a public health standpoint. It's had serious adverse economic, personal liberty, and other implications. So we need to do what we have to do to defeat COVID-19. At the same point in time, we need to be prudent because our finances have deteriorated dramatically. And therefore, we need to use good judgment as to what's included, how it's targeted, and what conditions are associated with it. You know, I hate to say this, Chase, but the fact is that it looks like we're going to get a roughly $1.9 trillion piece of legislation when it's all over and done with, most of which has absolutely nothing to do with COVID-19. You know, it's been said in the past that, you know, never let a crisis go to waste. What Congress has a history of doing is whenever they have something that they can call a crisis, they will end up loading a number of things into the legislation that has absolutely nothing to do with the so-called crisis. And that's clearly the case in connection with the current COVID-19 legislation. You know, my point was, let's give individuals who need the money, which is a much smaller set of people than the legislation is proposing. Okay. Let's also extend unemployment benefits for a period of time, but not at a level that would discourage people to go to work. Let's be able to reimburse states and localities for incremental expenses that are directly associated with COVID-19, and there are some. But let's also recognize that we have about $1 trillion that which already been appropriated in the past that hasn't been spent. And I could see how you could get to a number of around $1 trillion, given the political reality of where we are right now, but we've gone way more than that. And as I said, I think Congress has just absolutely lost control, and it's frankly not being straight with the American people about, you know, what this bill's all about.
I know Tori and Bob have questions they want to follow up with, but one I have, it goes off of something you just said. You mentioned that you could envision getting to a package of around $1 trillion relative to, you know, what you feel is needed at this point. How do you get to that number? I'm assuming you looked at, you know, the Republican package that was proposed leading up to this $1.9 trillion package. Was there any common ground there, you know, springboard from the Republican package to what you see now, or, you know, were both parties just sort of off base?
Well, the bottom line is the $1 trillion to $1.1 trillion that I talked about in the op-ed was not based solely on need. It was based on political reality, okay? And so the first thing you do is you get rid of things that have absolutely nothing to do with COVID-19, all right? And that includes a range of domestic and foreign spending that have absolutely nothing to do with COVID-19. In addition to that, you also get rid of things that that deal with multi-employer bailouts, which are about $90 billion, all right? Not that we don't need to do anything there, but it has nothing to do with COVID-19, okay? You also recognize that a lot of this bill, there's hundreds of billions of dollars of grants that are given to states and local governments that have nothing to do with direct and incremental expenses associated with COVID-19, all right? And so you make all of those changes, recognize political reality, and you can get to $1 trillion to $1.1 trillion. Candidly, if you just did it based upon what related to COVID-19 directly, it would be a lot closer to the number that the Republicans were talking about. But you do have to recognize political reality. The other thing I said in that op-ed, which I think is of critical importance, is no matter what the final bill is, we need to wake up, recognize reality. We're in much worse shape now than we were before COVID-19. We've got to put our finances in order. It's going to take a special mechanism to do it. And I advocated for a fiscal sustainability commission that's statutory, that learns the lessons from Simpson-Bowles, and that will set the table for tough choices sooner rather than later to put our finances in order. And after we put our finances in order, get on, enable the Federal Reserve to go back to sane monetary policy. Because right now we have unsustainable fiscal and monetary policies. And you're going to have to deal with the fiscal policy before you're going to be able to deal with the monetary policy.
And I do want to talk about the Fiscal Sustainability Commission. Before we get there, I want to hand it over to Tori, because this is right in her wheelhouse, and I'm sure she's really itching to ask a couple questions.
Well, I was going to ask a question about the Fiscal Sustainability Commission idea, only because, you know, Simpson-Bowles was very unique in that it was one of the few commissions that was actually made up of sitting members of Congress. So they actually had skin in the game. Political reality on the Hill since then has deteriorated in terms of the two parties being able to work together. So I'm curious, how would you structure this Fiscal Sustainability Commission? Would you comprise it of existing, you know, current lawmakers, or would you rely on a mix of outside experts, or would you just totally punt to people who are not, you know, facing the voters in the next election?
Tori, it would be a mix. I proposed a mix between sitting members of Congress and other experts. I also proposed that it be transpartisan. By that, I mean, you know, 43% of the voters in this country are unaffiliated, including myself. We don't belong to either political party. They deserve to have a seat at the table. I think it's important to be statutory, which means that both the Congress and the president buy in up front. I think it's important that both congressional leaders and the president be able to make appointments. I think it's important that we also have a different criteria for a commission recommendation. It should be 60% of the commission members, not 75%. Why do you want to set it up for failure? If 60% is good enough to get a vote in the Senate, it ought to be good enough to be able to get a vote in both houses of Congress, and a number of other things. So, but again, statutory, all right? And another thing that would be very different, Tori, is, you know, I've had a tremendous amount of citizen engagement experience around the country, in particular with regard to the 2012 10,000-mile national fiscal responsibility bus tour, $10 billion a minute. The answers are outside the Beltway. Ultimately, members of Congress have to vote, but you have to engage the American people with the facts, the truth, and the tough choices. You have to help them understand the burning platform. You have to help them understand the adverse consequences to our country, their children and grandchildren, if we fail to act. And you have to solicit their input into solutions before you make recommendations to the Congress. That was not done in Simpson-Bowles. It is a critical element. And I think the difference between success and failure.
So that brings up another interesting question. The left-leaning economists are having a debate right now about what the appropriate measure is of our level of indebtedness. You know, for years now, we've been using debt to GDP as sort of a metric to guide, you know, are we in a good place? Are we in a bad place? But now we've got this debate, you know, among certain economists that that's not a good measure, and that instead we should be focusing on things that like net interest relative to revenues, or just focusing solely on the fact that interest rates are low at the current moment and that we really don't need to worry about the debt. So I'm curious to what you think about that debate and that argument, because it goes to the question of how do we explain, you know, the need to make changes in policy and to get our fiscal situation in order when we can't even agree on whether or not we've got a debt problem.
Well, you're touching on the new modern monetary theory, and which basically say that deficits and debt don't matter as long as you can borrow in your own reserve currency or print your own reserve currency, unless and until you have excess inflation. All right. Well, let me tell you my concerns about that. Number one, it's unproven. Number two, it's contrary to history. Number three, it's based upon a flawed comparison to Japan, okay? Number four, it's likely to cause excess inflation if you follow it. And number five, which is my most significant concern, look, our politicians are already irresponsible. The last thing in the world that we need right now is some harebrained theory that basically says that you don't need to worry about anything because interest rates are artificially low right now. Okay. interest rates are not going to stay artificially low. Why are interest rates artificially low now? Because we are self-dealing in our own debt. The Federal Reserve is holding down interest rates. The Federal Reserve is buying new U.S. government debt. That is not a market-based system, all right? It's part of the problem with people want to do a lot of things and they don't want to pay for it. So they want to try to come up with crazy new theories to say you don't have to worry about it. And then when the bubble bursts, where are they?
No longer running for office.
No longer advising. The primary advocate of this, and I'm not going to mention any names, was the leading economic advisor to Bernie Sanders during the campaign. And the fact is now you know why Bernie Sanders never tried to answer, how are you going to pay for all this stuff? Because he had this crazy theory that says it doesn't matter. All right. Understand this. The higher debt to GDP goes, the slower economic growth, the less opportunity, the more we're paying for interest rather that we get nothing for rather than things that we should, the greater the risk of a fiscal crisis. The more adverse impact on our status as a superpower in the world, because the number one thing that it takes to be and remain a superpower is economic power. And that's what's threatened. All right. So I just think that, we're not exempt from the laws of prudent finance and we never will be. And it's time that we recognize that reality.
Well, Dave, I want to, that's not a bad way to jump into your book,
it's a pretty good book, Bob.
It's a real page turner.
Bob just raised the book up for the camera.
America in 2040, still a superpower with a question mark. So from what we were just talking about, elevating maybe from the weeds into the, I hope not the clouds here, but 30,000 feet, You cite some examples from history of republics that have risen and fallen and describe some characteristics. So drawing on your professorial experience now, what lessons from history do you think we should take and signs that alarm you?
Well, let's talk about a foreign one. Let's talk about a domestic message. A foreign one is the Roman Republic, the longest republic to stand, but it's gone now. And the empire succeeded the republic. And Rome failed for several reasons. One, fiscal irresponsibility, political incivility, moral decay, overextended military, and inability to control its borders. Does that sound familiar? Let me talk about another one, Washington. Washington, when he left office, and he could have been reelected again if he wanted to, but he decided he set the president for two terms. He gave us four warnings: avoid excessive debt, avoid foreign wars, avoid regionalism, and avoid factionalism, which he defined as political parties. How are we doing on that? Not too well. Let's fast forward to today. We are facing a re-emerging superpower. That superpower is China. It once had the largest economy in the world. It once had the largest navy in the world. And it now has the largest GDP based on purchasing power parity. It's passed us on the number of embassies in the world. It's number two militarily and dedicated to trying to pass us. And it's trying to spread its cultural influence. In addition to that, it's got a plan. We have no plan. This country has no strategic plan to try to focus on maintaining economic, diplomatic, military power and on improving things domestically. The growing gaps between the haves and the have-nots, the deteriorating infrastructure and the sustainability challenges that we face, such as our fiscal challenge, such as our environmental challenge. We have no plan. And all we do is we look on an annual to annual basis, and we throw money at things and we give tax preferences to things. And we don't even focus on what outcomes we're trying to achieve and whether or not we're achieving them. So, there's a lot of lessons from history and there's a lot of recent trends that we should be aware of and we should be doing something about. And if we do, we will remain a superpower in 2040 and our future will be better than our past. If we don't, our future is at risk.
Well, I want to follow up on that. He's threw a lot out there, Dave.
Being the youngest one in this group, Chase, you may have.
I'm your footing ears. The bill for all of this, no matter how you slice it. That and my 16-month-old son and Tori's kids. You paint in the book, at least just to kick things off, Dave, you paint kind of a bleak picture of what America could look like in 2040. What steps do you think need to be taken? And you sort of allude to this with the Fiscal Sustainability Commission, some of the things you just said, but could you, if you laid out a roadmap on how to get us on a better path, what would it look like?
First, you need a plan. The federal government has no strategic plan. You know, we need to recognize that what we're trying to do is we're trying to maintain our position in the world and improve our situation at home. We have no such plan. Okay. So you have to develop a plan. You have to be able to implement that plan. Okay. You need to recognize that you've got to be able to put your finances in order. And it's going to take some type of fiscal sustainability commission to be able to do that. Now, the book goes into a lot more than just fiscal issues. The book goes into immigration issues, environmental issues, infrastructure issues, and a variety of other things, many of which have fiscal implications, but not all of which have fiscal implications. Okay. So if you don't have a plan, all you have is prayer. I'm for prayer, but I'm for prayer and a plan. If you don't end up putting your finances in order, then ultimately you're going to have major economic problems, both domestically as well as the ripple effect implications internationally. And the book is three things. It's a wake-up call, because you got to wake people up first. It's a call to action, and it's a way forward. And over half the book is a way forward. And that way forward is based primarily, but not exclusively, on what representative groups of the American people said they felt were reasoned and reasonable actions to take in order to help create a better future.
I want to try and tie all this together in like three buckets, three issues I think we're facing right now. In addition to all the things that you're throwing out there, I think these are all tied together. With the Fiscal Sustainability Commission, with getting a plan together, one, what mechanisms or what efforts need to be put in place to hold policymakers' feet to the fire on anything like this, including a plan? Two, how do you get past the partisan brinkmanship that we're seeing? I mean, every time the majority shifts, we're just using reconciliation to do everything that, you know, we want to get through Congress, because we can't get buy-in from opposing parties.
I've taught you so well.
Yeah, you have, Tori. Great job. And three, how do you get the American people on board? Because it's not the 90s anymore, Dave. It's hard to walk into a room and say, hey, you should care about the debt, because they're like, who gives a rip? We've had deficits and low interest rates for over a decade. So those are three huge issues for anything, from what Concord is trying to do, from what you recommend needs to be done to put us on a better fiscal path. How do you tackle those things?
Well, first, on a plan, right now we have something called the Government Performance and Results Act, which applies to departments and agencies, and it doesn't apply to the federal government as a whole. There's no requirement to have a strategic plan. A lot of politicians don't want to have a strategic plan. Why? They don't want to be held accountable for results. Because if they got held accountable for results, and if they were under a pay for performance plan, they'd owe us money. Okay, it's as simple as that. So first you have to have a statutory mandate. Okay, you got to link it integrally with the budget process. All right. Secondly, with regard to the growing divide between politically, we need political reforms. And one of the things that's talked about in the book is there's a chapter that's focused exclusively on political reforms, the type of political reforms that we need to revitalize our democracy and to restore a republic that is truly representative of and responsive to the general public. We do not have that right now. Okay. And your third issue, what was your third issue?
How do you get the public on board? Getting them to care about,
the debt.
Yeah.
You got to tell them the truth. Okay. And that's why I say that that it's critically important to have the public engagement portion for a fiscal sustainability commission, because here's what I've found. The American people are a lot smarter than the politicians realize. They can understand the need for tough choices and are willing to accept tough choices if they're told the truth, if they understand what the adverse consequences to our future of our country, our children, grandchildren are if you don't make choices. If you help them come around a specific goal and principles and values that will bring people together rather than divide them apart, they are willing to accept those tough choices. And in fact, it's critically important that that be first in this effort so that they can put pressure on the politicians to be able to make those choices. And so the politicians will understand that they won't automatically lose their job if they fail to make those tough choices. See, that's part of the issue. But the number one thing that most elected officials care about, most human beings care about, is they want to keep their job. All right? Well, everybody likes tax cuts. Everybody likes additional government spending that's going to benefit them. All right? So all the cultural factors are downplay the problem, give them what they want now, and when I'm out of office, maybe it's going to blow up, but I'm going to be out of office. All right. Now, there are some exceptions here. I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but there are few exceptions today than there were 10 years ago and 20 years ago and 30 years ago. And all the more, and if you think that the regular order is going to get that done, you dream.
So
the regular order is not going to get it done.
So I have a question for you then, Dave. In terms of like small ball that you know, my dad always used to say singles win the game every time, small things that we can do to help perhaps the legislative process move a little bit more smoothly. There's some conversation about bringing back earmarks in the House and the Senate. And my question to you is whether or not you think earmarks are a way to take baby steps towards more bipartisanship and that you get, more bipartisan support for legislation, or is it just merely a way to spend more money?
Well, I think it's more important that we have more fundamental budget reforms than the earmarks. Okay. For example, most states have biennial budgeting. We ought to have biennial budgeting. Okay. Most states have capital and operating budgets. We ought to have capital and operating budgets. Okay. We're the only country in the world that has a debt ceiling limit. It's dumb and it doesn't work. Okay. We need to recognize that not all deficits are equal. Not all debt is equal. Sometimes you got to run deficits. Some debt can be good debt if it's investing in the future, all right, and properly designed, effectively implemented. All the more reason why don't focus on debt deficits. Don't focus on debt. Focus on debt to GDP, debt as a percentage of the economy, and interest as a percentage of the budget. I will agree with that. Interest as a percentage of the budget. Focus on those two things. So let's recalibrate our fiscal metrics. And let's put some controls in place that focus on those two things. And let's have more transparency, automatic triggers, and automatic enforcement mechanisms. Things will happen if you fail to hit certain targets. All right. Including some of those things could be positive. Some of those things could be, hey, if we do better than we thought, you can have a dividend on your tax return. But if we don't do better than we thought, then we're going to have some spending cuts and maybe a surcharge. And that's all very transparent. So people can see it. People can feel it. What's happening right now is they're not being told the truth. They don't see it. They don't feel it. They don't understand it. And our mechanisms aren't put in place for them to be able to do that. I mean, I just covered with my midshipman the financial statements for 2019. And the fact that we're supposed to be in the hole $22 trillion, when in reality, if you actually have more honest accounting, mm-hmm. we're in the hole almost $100 trillion.
Right.
We don't even tell people the truth.
And by that you mean the unfunded liabilities in Social Security, yeah. and Medicare, and other yeah. Mm-hmm.
We don't even count the debt that's in the debt held in the debt ceiling limit. We only count debt held by the public. We don't count debt held by the trust fund. $6 trillion. Okay. On the other hand, we don't count the millions of acres of lands that we own that theoretically. Might have some value associated with it if we ever decided to do anything with it. So the bottom line is that, we're not providing adequate transparency. Our systems and controls are not geared towards achieving the kinds of decisions and outcomes that we need to create a better future.
I've got an idea, and I've been thinking about this for a long time. I think if we cut waste, fraud, and abuse and foreign aid, we could really solve most
Come
of
on, Bob.
Thank you for playing.
Just making sure that you're all still awake. Now, the one thing I did want to say on a more serious note is that I think the timing for this fiscal commission idea is good because, and maybe getting better as we go on, because so long as you had the COVID crisis, and we still have it, I don't want to talk about it in the past tense, But the huge, enormous bill that just passed, nearly $2 trillion, which has, and you're right, has lots of stuff in it. It's got new entitlement spending in it. It's going to be very hard to shut off. That goes through on the basis of emergency spending. The next thing down the road is the regular budget. The president will submit a budget very shortly. It's going to have huge proposals in it. It won't be, you can't, it's going to get more scrutiny, I think, I hope, because it's not an emergency measure. So having just done another couple trillion dollars on top of the $3 trillion deficit from last year, I think when people start thinking about a new budget, they're going to start, I think, I hope, start thinking about, can we just write everything off as deficit finance now? Are we going to have to start coming up with some pay-fors for this stuff, either in cutting other spending or finding new sources of revenue that would pay for it? Because I just don't think you can do another huge agenda through the regular budget and just tell people you're going to pay for it by running up the debt.
Well, I would agree. I think what I've said is, look, we need to do whatever we have to in order to defeat COVID-19. And we will defeat COVID-19. Frankly, we've done more than we should have from a fiscal standpoint. But what happens, happens. But now I think we have to recognize that while we were already on an unsustainable path before COVID-19, we're in much, much worse shape now. And you're not going to be able to continue to be able to point to COVID-19 for reason to spend money on things that don't have anything to do with COVID-19. So I would argue that it's time to do penance. All right. It's to recognize that, that some things that have been done were needed, some things that were done were not needed, and that we've kicked the can down the road too long. And therefore, we ought to include some type of fiscal sustainability commission in the next budget bill.
And if we have to be, there has to be pressure for pay-fors and, the old pay-go rule. And I think you're right on getting the public involved in this.
Yeah, but I think it ought to be included in the next budget bill. And if we have to do it through budget reconciliation or we get the 50 votes, so be it. But what we have to do is we've got to have, more systems and controls that will force these types of fiscal guardrails. And in addition to that, we need to be able to engage the public in a way that politicians have been hesitant to do it, so that the public can be supportive of the needs of these changes. Let's understand, we're not talking about dramatic changes overnight. We're talking about making changes that will be phased in over time so that we can get the miracle of compounding working for us rather than against us. Because if you look at what CBO is saying, if you look at what OMB is saying, if you look at what the Federal Reserve chair has been saying, they're all saying we got to get control of our finances. We've got to get control of our finances. And so let's figure out how best to get that done sooner rather than later.
And unfortunately, we are out of time. I think we could spend hours and hours talking about these topics. We're all incredibly passionate about them, but we're going to have to call it quits for today and bring you back, Dave. This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to former Comptroller General Dave Walker, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and Concord's Policy Director Tory Gorman discuss COVID relief, the idea of a fiscal sustainability commission, and highlights from Dave's latest book, which looks ahead to what America might look like in 2040 if we don't engage in some reform and change. Thank you for joining the show, Bob, Tory, and Dave.
Thanks. Thank you.
Up next, Bob and Tory will be back and we'll discuss the latest in COVID-19 relief and how the reconciliation process is wrapping up. Be back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby and Tory Gorman. Bob is the Concord Coalition's Executive Director. Tory is Concord's Policy Director, both regular contributors on the show. Welcome back, Bob and Tory.
Thanks, Chase.
Thanks, Chase.
Happy to have you both here, and we're going to cover some very timely topics in a very brief segment, and that is COVID relief and reconciliation. They've been frequent guests on our program in terms of topics over the last couple months, but rightly so, given what's going on with the pandemic. So, Tory, I'm going to kick things over to you with a really general question. What's the latest on COVID relief? Where are we?
So the House passed their version. The Senate passed their version, made some changes to the House passed version. So the Senate is sending their bill back to the House. You can imagine that, you know, it's a 600 plus page bill in the Senate, and they added a lot of changes, about 58 pages worth of changes over in the Senate, if not more. So the people that are responsible for enrolling the legislation in the House are busy trying to incorporate all of those changes, making sure that all of the paperwork is exactly what it's supposed to be. Then they'll send that enrolled bill over to the House for the House to pass. They're expecting to get that paperwork either late tonight or early tomorrow. So the House is expected to vote Tuesday, Wednesday on passage of the American Recovery Plan.
Are they expected to sort of accept what came over from the Senate, or might we see some more changes?
I think the expectation is they'll just pass, because it's the bill is coming out of the Senate is what the Senate could bear, right? So it's one of those instances where the House is just going to have to accept what the Senate has passed.
What were some of the major changes between the House's bill and what the Senate is effectively sending back?
Sure. I think there are three big changes that I think that are the primary focus, at least in terms of how they affect people. Number one, the minimum wage was dropped. It was not compliant with Byrd rule. So the Democrats had to drop it from their legislation. Two, the recovery rebates were adjusted a little bit to be a little bit more targeted. Those are the $1,400 checks that are being sent to households, individuals, and dependents. The income cutoff remains the same, 75,000 single, 150,000 for married filing joint. And then the phase out is what has changed. So right now, what used to be sort of a relatively gentle phase out in the qualification for the rebates is now a pretty hard stop at 80 grand for individuals and 160 grand for people that are married filing jointly. And from what I am hearing, that means that are about 8 million people that would have initially qualified for recovery rebates under this change would not qualify for recovery rebates this time around.
Did most of those changes, I know the $15 minimum wage that was cut out, we've talked about, that was part of the parliamentarians' recommendations, but was everything else pretty much part of a strenuous Votorama session?
Most of the changes came through Votorama. And I did want to mention one more change, and that was the unemployment insurance. You know, the House passed a version of unemployment insurance that provided that weekly pandemic extra benefit of $400 a week. And the Senate, in order to be a little bit more targeted and to promote a return to work effort, reduced that from $400 to $300. But they did extend unemployment insurance through September 6th, an extra week. And they also decided that the first $10,200.
Something like that,
are exempt from taxation. So unemployment insurance benefits are taxable. And so they exempted the first 10,000 approximately from tax. So those are the big changes that they made to the unemployment insurance over in the Senate.
And Bob, I want to bring you into the conversation as well. Any questions you might have, but I have one for you first. And that is, we've talked about on the show how what was coming down the pike didn't necessarily fall into the three T's in some respects. Are we looking at something similar where there are chunks of this bill that aren't timely, targeted, or temporary, at least as they pertain to the emergency?
Yeah, chunks.
Large chunks, small chunks.
I think there's, yes. There are chunks that are timely, targeted, and temporary. Look, this is a crisis. And if people say, you know, never let a crisis go to waste. So there certainly was a lot of stuff in this bill, which, by the way, is now being heavily touted by proponents for reasons that are not related to COVID, that have, you know, major expansions of benefits, which are temporary in the technical sense in the bill, but everybody understands them to be a permanent change that will They're not intended to be temporary, and the proponents are not suggesting that they should be temporary. And
sort of like the 2017 individual tax cuts.
Yeah.
That are supposed to quote sunset or not be.
Well, this is what you do when you have reconciliation. You've got to sunset things to monkey with the score and to show that it's not having a long-term effect on the deficit. So I think that when all is said and done, what will be remembered about this bill many, many years from now, I think, is the expansion, major expansion of tax credits for children. I mean, basically, you have the child tax credit, you have the children and dependents tax credit, and you have the earned income tax credit. There are a lot of things that are in the code now that have been greatly expanded and that are projected to cut poverty by a third or child poverty by half, which would be enormous accomplishments, not something you would associate with going into an emergency spending bill for a pandemic, but they're in there. And this is why I don't like doing things on an emergency bill through reconciliation. I'm not questioning the goals at all. It's that this was done without the sort of hearings and scrutiny that you, and more importantly, offsets, that you would expect for such a major expansion. This is like we have, you know, since the 30s and then in the 60s, you had Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid really attacking poverty among the elderly, which was a huge problem. What we've just slipped into a COVID bill is a major governmental decision to greatly expand aid to children, to families with children. And I suspect that that is not going to go away, that it will probably grow over time. And there's no way to pay for it. So you can say with Social Security or Medicare that they have dedicated sources of revenue. I think one of the biggest challenges for policymakers for the Biden administration in the coming year is going to be extending those programs, if that's what they want to do, in a way that makes them fiscally sustainable. Because as we always like to remind people, we went into this problem with a budget that was already $1 trillion out of whack and on an unsustainable track. So we have the seeds here of a major increase in entitlement spending. Maybe it's time that we have an expansion on entitlement spending directed at children. But the missing element here is some plan to pay for it.
We've talked a lot about reconciliation. You talked about where the COVID bill is, but what's left in the reconciliation process? And are legislators ramping up for another reconciliation bill in the near term?
So once the House passes the bill, it goes to the president for his signature, which is expected to happen sometime on Thursday. And then they get started on the next budget cycle. This sort of completes fiscal 2021 budget cycle. We've funded the government. We've passed a budget resolution. We've passed the reconciliation bill. So then they start on fiscal 2022. And that starts with President Biden submitting his budget to Congress. So hopefully we'll see that in April, May-ish, I think, sometime. Mm-hmm. And then that starts the process anew with a fiscal 22 budget resolution, which potentially may have reconciliation instructions in it to committees. You know, we don't know for sure yet. The administration has been a little bit cagey about, you know, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who is now the Secretary of Transportation, has declared that this is infrastructure year. The question is, are they going to try and do that? A major infrastructure investment bill via reconciliation, or are they going to try to do it under regular order? It remains to be seen. But I'm expecting another reconciliation bill. But I will admit, I will be pleasantly surprised if there isn't one.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Concord's Policy Director Tory Gorman discuss the latest on COVID relief and wrapping up the reconciliation process, at least for now. Thanks for joining the show, Bob and Tory.
Thank you, Chase.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.